tell you a story. This is true. I'm not going to use any names, but I was away and I came back and she told me she had been raped. But she handled the situation of the rape in the most extraordinary way. But my immediate reaction was, I asked, did she know who it was? No. What colour were they? She said it was a black person. I went up and down areas with a cosh, hoping I'd be approached by somebody. I'm ashamed to say that. And I did it for maybe a week, hoping some black bastard would come out of a pub and have a go at me about something, you know, so that I could kill him. And it was out. It took me a week, maybe a week and a half, to kind of go for that. And she said to me, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm just going out for a walk, you know." She said, "What's wrong?" "No, no, nothing's wrong. Fine." And it was horrible. Horrible when I think back, but I did that, and I've never admitted that to, and I'm saying it to a journalist, God forbid.
Holy shit.
It's awful. But I did learn a lesson from it when I eventually thought, what the fuck are you doing, you know? And I come from a society, I grew up in Northern Ireland in the Troubles, and I knew a couple of guys that died on hunger strike, and I had acquaintances that were very caught up in the Troubles. And I understand that need for revenge, but it just leads to more revenge and more killing and more killing. And, you know, Ireland, Northern Ireland is proof of that, you know. All the stuff that's happening in the world at the minute, the violence is proof of that, you know. So it's... but that's... Yeah, primal need, I understand, you know.
Tonight, new concerns about a Cold War-style missile showdown between America and its biggest nuclear rival, Russia, after Vladimir Putin announced he wants to create a new medium-range nuclear-tipped missile with supersonic capability similar to this.
Not only are they far faster, so they're incredibly difficult to intercept, but they also have very little flight time, so there's very little warning or possibility for the defending side to do much of anything about it.
Experts say Putin could be ready to deploy that missile, which would be capable of flying faster than the speed of sound, within a few years. More concerning, they say, is that the Russian leader wants to modify a dangerous missile already in his arsenal. It's a cruise missile called the Caliber, similar to an American Tomahawk that Russia has previously launched from ships and submarines. The Russian president now wants to deploy a land-launched version.
Caliber realistically can threaten all of Europe.
Analysts say that means all of America's European allies and U.S. forces stationed throughout the continent will be in the line of fire of Putin's new missiles, each having a range of at least 1,000 miles.
There are about 6 or 7 major bases of all services throughout Europe, some major air bases, certainly the ground bases, which contain the 30,000 or so U.S. Army soldiers there, some naval bases in the Mediterranean.
Putin's push to improve his arsenal comes just days after the U.S. announced it is suspending a key Cold War treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or INF. That deal forced the U.S. and Russia to eliminate the same kinds of missiles that Putin is now talking about developing, which can fly between 300 and 3,400 miles. The U.S. accused Russia of violating that treaty by secretly testing and deploying those missiles. The U.S. says if Russia doesn't back down, it will withdraw completely. The Russians deny they have violated the deal. Over the weekend, Putin went as far as to promise he would not act first.
Russia will not deploy medium or short-range weapons unless such weapons appear, either in Europe or in other parts of the world, until such weapons of American origin appear in these regions.
But experts say Putin has been aggressively trying to advance many of his weapons capabilities. Last year, he boasted of trying to develop a supersonic ICBM, or intercontinental ballistic missile, capable of reaching the United States. A nuclear-powered cruise missile with unlimited range, even an underwater nuclear-armed drone.
He will take every advantage he possibly can, to include an attempt at new military confrontations conventionally. He's going to push it until someone pushes back on him.
Things happen with non-white people based on what the white supremacists decide. We are under their jurisdiction. That's what white supremacy means. They do what they please. And so if they decide to broadcast something, it will be broadcast. If they decide that it won't be broadcast, it won't be broadcast. And if anybody gets mad about it, if, you know, somebody wants it broadcast and it's not, the white supremacist says, well, you can get mad, but you're still my prisoners of war. And I determine what you do and what you don't do. And that's the end of that story. Because after all, it's one bottom line here. You are not big enough, bad enough, or smart enough to whip me and make me do anything. And I can make you do anything that I want done, including die, and nobody will do anything about that.
Enough is enough. We are sick and tired of having targets on our back. And if you're the ones that are out there spreading the rhetoric that police officers are the enemy, well, just know we've all got your number now. We're going to be keeping track of all of y'all, and we're going to make sure that we hold you accountable every time you stir the pot on our police officers.
The police!
That's what they are. They're an occupation army, and they have declared a war against Black America.
Five killed Thursday night by what is believed to be two snipers who opened fire during a demonstration in downtown Dallas.
Officer Mia Sotis Familia, so determined to wear the blue, she left her job as a nurse in her mid-30s. Her gunman shot her in the head at point-blank range through a passenger side window.
I bought a shot!
What's your name, sir?
She told you.
Did I f***ing ask you if she told me? I asked you what your name is. Answer the f***ing question.
Oh, f*** you pigs.
Do you need police assistance, sir?
Could you get the f*** away from me, please?
I dare you to touch me.
I dare you to touch me.
They think this is funny. You're going to see funny. Because I'm real f***ing funny.
Don't give me your bullshit. I fund you. I'm working on it. Shut the f*** up.
I'll tell you what. Once you have that thing,
you.
To the station.
I'll do it with this whole crowd, asshole.
I need your card.
Excuse you, officer. Police brutality.
Burning the cop flag. Yeah.
This is the thin blue line flag.
I cannot believe it. You guys.
Well, I'm getting going. I got better shit to do than with f***ing sit here and talk with you bitches. F*** you guys and have a good day.
Right,
f***ing pigs.
You can't silence my voice. I don't know what the f*** is wrong with you pulling out in front of a bus. No justice. No peace. F*** this stupid ass District 6 police.
No, you have no idea what's going on here.
All of this is being recorded. Touch me right now. No, mother. Do you understand that you are not a law firm investigator?
220, could you start me? Step away from me.
F*** you, bitch. If you hit me like that again, I will f*** you up. Do you understand that?
Step away
from me. Do not touch me, bitch.
You're under arrest.
You're going to identify yourself clearly to me. What is your name, servant?
0077.
Pronounce last name?
Sedaris! That's his name, babe!
Most white supremacists say, who, me?
Yes.
I'm not a white supremacist. I don't believe in racism. I'm a nice guy. Hey, I'll shake your hand. You know? If you want a hug, I'll give it to you. You know, I don't believe in that stuff and all like that. And all the time, he's wink, wink, wink.
Yeah.
All right. This is the modern day, the refined white supremacist. Mr. John Wayne apparently wasn't very refined. That's why I'm quite sure that the refined white supremacist said, hey, you know, we all feel that way.
Yeah.
You don't say it out loud.
Dear young people,
Don't vote.
Everything's fine the way it is.
Trump, that was us.
He's our guy.
Tax cuts for the rich? Hell yeah, I'm rich as fuck.
Climate change? That's a you problem.
I'll be dead soon.
Sure, school shootings are sad.
But I haven't been in a school for 50 years.
I can't keep track of which lives matter.
Sure, you don't like it. So, you'll like some meme on Instagram.
If the weather is nice, maybe you could go to one of those little marches.
You might even share this video on Facebook.
But you won't vote.
You young people never do.
But I do. I do.
I do.
Midterms, primaries.
Every single election.
We'll be there, but you won't.
Because we're a generation of doers.
Not whiners.
And we're doing great.
Y'all love the Asians in Nintendo. Y'all love the white people at Microsoft. Y'all love the white people at PS4. Embrace the black community, academics. I can bring you on board and you can even have a DJ Academics game. You twitch your stream all day playing Fortnite and shit.
Hold on, but I'm not
support the black community. It's not a scam. Every game on here is licensed. It's 800 PS4 games that are licensed. I sold $1 million in one day. Nintendo approached me.
Why would they approach you?
Come on, academics.
Why would they approach you?
Because they're trying to see what the fuck going on. It's a young black kid that made $1 million within 24 hours
and
our games are on the consoles. We want in.
Name it on the box.
Yo, it's the first prototype. It's to cut me some slack. Like, I'm a black entrepreneur. I done made $1 million off this motherfucking console. Look, check this out. Look.
Yo, why do you have so many businesses?
You right. And you say seven orders.
It says seven orders for $212,000. Hold on a minute. Let me show the camera. I got to show the camera.
Go ahead.
Hold on.
I love
it.
Why do you have so many businesses, though?
Right there.
Because I'm a fucking bona fide hustler. I'm trying to be a billionaire. Why don't you have that many businesses?
When it comes to games, not just video games, games as a whole, African people have a historical, in fact, the historical contribution to games. It's a part of our culture, which is kind of funny because in today's time, most of our parents tell us, you know, go read a book, or go find something else to do, go get a job, X, Y, and Z, because they don't think video games has any other purpose. And it's a waste of time. But when we look at our culture and we look at our history, the world's oldest recorded game is a game called Senet, right? S-E-N-E-T. It's an Egyptian game. And this goes back to like 1200, 3100 BC. There's a picture of Queen Nefertari actually playing the game. It's a game about moving from life to death. And creating games has been in African culture literally for thousands of years. So this is something that we create games so that we can enhance our mind, our thinking, true IQ, true critical thinking, not like the IQ test because they want to trade this race is better than that race, not that foolishness, but like actual critical thinking about how to play and strategize. From Senet, chess was made. So that's how old the game is. And chess is a thinking man's game, so to speak. And then you have other games that think dominoes, we account, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's always been a part of our life and our culture for gaming. So much that when it comes to video games, right, there's a gentleman, Jerry. I can't remember his last name. I think it's Lawson. I'm not too sure. But he's the father of the video game cartridge. Like, he created video game cartridges, so the game packs themselves. Because when video games first started, they would make a computer, and in the computer is the game. So you play the game off the computer. But he created the cartridges that you put into an actual console to actually play, or at that time the old PCs. He invented that, and that's an African man. So it goes from Queen Nefertari to Kim, and to players like myself. Well, I'm retired now, but the point is that, you know, we have the number one winning video game team in the world. I mean, the International Video Game Hall of Fame. So we have a well in-depth history. And there's so many other people like me when it comes to modern day video games that our history connects. And we need to create a platform where we can educate people to that.
Womanism is a black feminist economic endeavor.
Let's do it.
All right, so last week I left off with, I guess, a somewhat controversial thesis, namely that black feminism uses a race-sex identity to partner with white women for political and economic power. And I argue that what this, in fact, does is it allows them to use gender oppression to hide their economic motivations behind aligning themselves with the second most powerful racial group in America. Now, I want to explain something. This is not only a political ideology, but this is also driven by a demographic change in the university. Right now, black women get 2/3 of the PhDs that's awarded to black people. So even though this is a type of discursive idea that comes about in disciplines like women's studies or black feminism, it's also driven by this demographic fact that you have black women now competing for jobs against other black men and other white women on these types of issues. Now, there's an obvious reality here that black men, black children are subject to the same types of abuses that black women are subject to. So even though black feminism tries to make an exclusive claim to the types of sexual and gender abuses that happen, things like rape, especially prison rape I've mentioned before, child abuse, poverty, these are all things that happen to the black community based on their sexuality in a white supremacist society. Now, what black feminism tries to do is it takes as given that the patriarchal culture that we see in a larger Eurocentric society or white society and the power of white society also translates into the power that black men have over them. So it's the domination of black women by black men. So this is where the idea I've mentioned before that black male privilege gains its ground in the academy. But this is nothing more than a kind of mythology, because what happens here is that this is not sociologically proven. It's not like we're holding sociological and economic conferences or writing papers. To date, there's no peer-reviewed paper on black male privilege that actually shows how it benefits black men on the long run. So then this ideology itself gains footing, because what you have is an economic motivation, black women with PhDs trying to fight for limited academic and disciplinary spaces against black male academicians. So there's an economic driving force where black men now become the primary economic competitors in academic spaces with black feminists. So as we know from Reconstruction to now, there's a type of racial scapegoating that goes on that's pushed forward by an economic motivation that aligns with the ideological stereotypes that black people have, or black women, or black feminists in this case, have of other black men. So what we have to think about then is how these economic motivations behind this ideology of black feminism is not only pushing the types of things they put out, but also the analysis they give us of the black community. Now, this differs from a large view from what I'm going to talk about, which is race-conscious womanism. And what happens in the academy is that there's this view that black feminism is the only legitimate way for us to study sexuality and gender, that if you're not a black feminist, then you have everything wrong. But black womanism, or race-conscious womanism, takes a different view. First, it argues that black men and women have always been partners in the struggle against racism and sexism, or what Claudia Jones called racial chauvinism. So what this movement says is that black men are also victimized and disempowered and oppressed in society, just like their women are. And this differs a great deal from how white feminists looks at the situation, because in a white society, white women are subjected to their men. That's the concept, that there's a patriarchal society, so they're being repressed and oppressed by white men. That's not necessarily the case when you look at a black society, because in black society, you're looking at black men and black women competing for economic goods and economic resources against a dominant white supremacist society that doesn't value the black man or the black woman. So whereas black feminism wants to articulate a kind of bifurcated or, in academic language, an intersectional identity, womanism is very clear that race and the material conditions of racism and neocolonialism are first and foremost in how we perceive and deal with black existence. So when you think about the people that we talk about for Black History Month, T. Thomas Forster, Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, these individuals were, in fact, a great supporters and advocates of black women's literacy, education, and economic empowerment. For example, Booker T. Washington funded his wife's school, Maggie Washington's industry for home economics. So there's this move that black men see that black women are fundamentally important and central to the idea of black people rising up as a race. Now, the problem I have when we talk about black feminism is that there's a type of intellectual dishonesty that exists in the narrative that tells black people generally, that this is out the academy, it wants to tell black people generally that every movement for rights, be it the civil rights movement or the black power movement, was about where black men died and were assassinated at the hands of white people, was fundamentally about black men seeking to dominate women. Whereas the women's movement, and this is what really gets me, the women's movement that was organized on the back of black people's blood and deaths against the police, the CIA, and the government, and led by the same middle-class white women who had black mammies and black domestics working for them and accepted the rape of black women from slavery all the way to segregation, somehow had the interests of black women at heart. So you have individuals who fundamentally benefited, white women who benefited from the exploitation of black women in the home so they could go to college, so they could get money in the workforce, fundamentally get to say now that they've started a movement that you should leave aside the black power movement, the civil rights movement, which was fighting for the integration of people, black people in the United States, and trust their economic interest over that against that of the race. And this, you have to really think about this. This is like I was saying last week. There is a tendency for us not to understand the complexity of American racism, where we suggest that every woman, be it a black woman or a white woman, has not been able to be, cannot be held accountable and culpable for the type of racism that goes on in society. So when we talk about what black womanism or race-conscious womanism does versus black feminism, we have to keep our mind on the anti-black racist nature and the anti-black violence in society and how black people, the black community, black men and women as a whole, chose to respond to that violence. And I think that race-conscious womanism centers that kind of reality against the economic-driven motivations of the contemporary black feminist movement in the academy today.
Well said, Dr. Tommy Curry. Dr. Tommy Curry, how can folks get in contact with you?
They can hit me on Twitter at Dr. TJC.
You've been listening to Ready News Review, the podcast.
The greatest tragedy of the African diaspora is that it displaced all of our people throughout the Americas and the Caribbean, displacing the culture of our diverse heritage. But through all of this, we as a people have never lost our desire to live free under our own sovereignty, governing ourselves. And one of the greatest examples of this took place in a country known as Brazil with a Maroon community called Quilombo dos Palmares.
Maroons have existed as long as we have come in contact with the yoke of slavery known as the Western world, whether it's throughout the Caribbean, Veracruz, Mexico, Brazil, Peru, North America. Maroons have always existed. The important thing about Maroons is that Maroons show us the ability to make something happen with an agenda. The Maroon agenda was to be liberated, to live upon your own terms, to have your own way of life. Not only were they willing to have these things, they was willing to fight, live, and die for them. The Maroons had the mentality that they could not continue to live in the way that they lived. They had a mentality of sacrifice. One of the main things that they knew they had to sacrifice was what we know as individualism. Maroons sacrificed this concept of individualism. They formed a mentality that they were going to be free together, they was going to live together, they was going to fight together, and by any means, if they had to, they would die together. So this is what's important about the Maroon mentality, is that it had a one unified plural mindset.
Quilombo dos Palmares became one of the largest Maroon communes, at its height holding anywhere from 10 to 20,000 people. According to the historians of Brazil, sometime during the 16th century, 40 rebellious Africans escaped captivity of a sugar mill near Porto Calvo in the region Pernambuco in northeast Brazil. In higher plains, they found solitude, a place full of palm trees, fertile soil, a lot of water, and an abundance of wildlife. They called this place, which was built on the foundation of communalism and self-determination, Quilombo, a word in the Mbundu African language, which meant war camp. A community led and comprised mostly of Angolans became well organized with the complex social structure of leaders similar to the infrastructure our ancestors were accustomed to back in Africa. And you ask if blacks can get along. We can. And we did, under one common mission, one common goal, to live how we were accustomed to living and to fight white supremacy from ruling over us. The Portuguese fought the Quilombos the entire time of its existence, except for when the Dutch controlled the area. And for those years, our ancestors fought the Dutch. And in between fighting the Portuguese and the Dutch, the Quilombo community continued to grow.
I come from a special place called Not Having Much, trying to build my house on Easy Street since we had it tough. It's little niggas online keep taking stabs at us, but I'm too stingy to even give half a fuck. Godspeed.
Welcome to another episode of Real Life, the radio show. I am your host, Jenna Capra, alongside my co-host, Brother Roz. Today is February the 5th, 2019, and we hope that you are somewhere safe, warm, and having the best time that you possibly could have right now joining us tonight. Brother Roz, how are you doing this evening?
I'm still learning. I'm doing good. It's great to be live with you tonight and with the callers and listeners as well. How are you doing?
Still learning as well. And I've been forgetting to do a whole bunch of things last couple of months. A lot been on my plate. So let's get the beginning out the way. If you enjoy, pull anything from any of the shows here on this network, by all means, go to BTRN. I'm sorry. Am I saying this correctly? I'm jacking this all the way up. Black Talk Radio Network.
Black Talk Radio Network. Yeah.
Excuse me. BlackTalkRadioNetwork.com. And go down to hit the donate button so you could help Brother Scotty continue to provide shows such as this to give you the current news from a black perspective, and also just to get you thinking in a different way. You know, the definition of insanity, we've said it many of times, continue to do the same thing expecting a different result. So with that being said, Brother Rise, before we get to any of the clips, I know you wanted to discuss this article you found about cell phones. Now, I done went through it, and go ahead and introduce it to the people.
No problem. I'll go through it. It's not that long at all, but I think it's quite important because it could happen to anyone, and it's been happening and growing. So this is from, excuse me, the Inc.com. That's the online site. And there's a article entitled, let's get out of here.
Your cell phone is a security threat. Hackers can use to steal your accounts. Luckily, there's a fix. That's the title.
There we go. Thank you. So it says, you can't keep your phone number secret, but here's how to protect it. If you are at all savvy about online security, you already know to be cautious about sharing really identifiable information. You think twice before you post your birth date to social media or tell people your street address or your mother's maiden name. But there's one piece of personal information you can't avoid giving out, your mobile phone number. Without it, no one would be able to contact you. Whenever you buy anything online, subscribe to a new service, meet a new friend, or sign up for any kind of text notification, it's something you inevitably share. It turns out that in the wrong hands, that simple piece of information can be used to steal your identity and take over nearly every online account you have. And it's surprisingly easy for hackers to do just that in a simple two-step process. Step one, a hacker who's found out your phone number and one or two other bits of information, such as your address and or date of birth, contacts your mobile carrier claiming to be you. The hacker tells your carrier to quote-unquote port out your number to a different phone, one in the hacker's possession. If your provider asks questions such as your address and date of birth to confirm you, the hacker will answer them correctly. Soon the hacker has switched your phone and is able to receive calls and texts intended for you. You will probably continue receiving calls and texts as well, so you may have no idea that anything has changed. Step two, the hacker logs into your email account. Whoops. The hacker doesn't know your password, but that's okay. The hacker can tell your email software that he or she forgot the password, quote unquote, and have a reset sent to your quote unquote mobile phone. You've probably given your email provider your mobile phone number as a backup in case you ever forget your password, in which case this is a pretty easy step. Thankfully, I've never done that. Once the hacker has access to your email account, it's easy to gain access to any of your other accounts. Just click forgot password and wait for a password reset link to arrive in what was once your email. If you have a two-factor authentication enabled on any of your accounts, the secret codes will be sent to the hacker at quote-unquote your phone number. He or she can even gain access to your bank accounts, And if the hacker calls the bank, the caller ID will make it look like the call is coming from you. Quote unquote, forgot password. Are you scared yet? You should be. This is not a theoretical security flaw. There are real live hackers using mobile numbers to access people's accounts right now. Millions of dollars in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies have been stolen this way already. It even happened to TechCrunch writer John Biggs, who was locked out of all of his online accounts in the space of a half an hour. Cryptocurrency owners like Biggs are primary targets because transactions in cryptocurrency can't be reversed. So it's easier to get away with and easier to spend the money without being tracked. But it could happen to anyone at any time. So what can you do about it? Actually, there's a pretty simple way to prevent it. Let your mobile carrier know that you want to add an extra layer of security or password to your account, something that you can often do online. Scroll to the end and see how to add extra security to AT&T, T-Mobile, Verizon, and Sprint accounts. You may also want to simply call your carrier and ask them to enable this extra protection. Once it's in place, anyone who tries to make changes to your mobile account, such as switching it to a different phone or SIM chip, will need to provide this password first, effectively preventing anyone who doesn't know the password from stealing your phone number and all that goes with it. It's a small extra effort that can give you a lot of peace of mind. And it ends there. And I've done exactly that a very long time ago. But I think it's very important for everyone to know about this, especially if you do utilize or dabble in cryptocurrency, because you're going to be a hot commodity for someone to do something like this too. And like they said, it runs rampant, and it's very simple, but a highly effective way to steal everything, because pretty much your phone is you. It's basically a digital version of you, an avatar. So yeah, just want to put that out there. Do you want to add anything to that, Jenna?
Oh no, you covered it pretty much. You have been telling me about this for quite some time, and almost forced me to start understanding and purchase my own. So I appreciate that, and just it kind of just flows out whenever we have these discussions. Seem like the news reports show up to give a little verification,
corroborate. Yeah, it's like it corroborates everything. And we don't know these people, but it just tends to work out. I guess the timing's impeccable.
Yep, foresight.
Yeah.
And I appreciate you for that.
That's a good way of describing it.
But back I know you wanted to get with the Dr. Curry. But before that, did you have any of those clips that you wanted to speak on?
Yes, I actually made some brief notes. I'll probably end up chiming in as you bring up stuff too. Liam Neeson, very interesting that he basically went back to this, I think it was a bar, if I remember correctly, for 2 weeks waiting at the bar. And I remember when I read the article on it, he said he wanted to kill a black bastard was the exact words he had used in the interview he had. From what they quoted him in the article that I read. And to say that I don't understand the idea of wanting to get revenge, and I mean, we as especially black males, but just males in general, something happens to someone that you care about, and the person, let's say, is on the loose and they haven't been caught, you're going to want justice in some form or fashion. So it's not that I don't understand that, but then you're talking about in a system of white supremacy. And you're talking about, you know, the way he was discussing it, it wasn't like he knew who it was or he was waiting to get that specific person. He just wanted to get a black male.
Yeah, just a random black
so
male.
So this is a random black male. So this is ultimately what they did with lynching. They would just pick a black person, black male, drag him out of his house and lynch him, whether he was guilty or not. And I don't know if you ever saw there's a book by a man named James Cameron called The Time of Terror. And he was about, I think, 15 years old when him and two of his friends were falsely accused of sexually assaulting a white woman. And they were going to string him up. They actually killed his two friends. The mob that came outside the jail, they broke into jail, dragged him and his two friends out, beat the two that they did lynch to a pulp before hanging them. It's one of the most famous lynching pictures in the country. If you have the book Without Sanctuary, that picture's in there. If you've ever just looked up lynching pictures at all, you're going to find the pictures of James Cameron's two friends. And he had what he describes as a divine intervention from the creator when the crowd was pummeling him and preparing to lynch him like they did his two friends. And because of that divine intervention, the crowd let him go. And he died in the earlier 2000s. I think he might have died in like 2012 or 2010. And his story is extremely profound. It's not a thick book at all, but it's a firsthand account of the only known lynching survivor. And I've had that book for years. It's one that will leave an imprint on you if you've never read it before, just to have him explain it in his own words, and the ancestors now passed away. Mm-hmm. But it's an incredible story. So when Liam Neeson, in that clip, that's all I could think about, is just the way that white people just randomly pick a black person, kill them, and then they claim something like that. Oh, something happened to somebody, and, you know, I just wanted to get back at them. And because we're in the system of white supremacy, any black man will do, because any black man has always done. We have always been, oh, yeah, just take one, any one of them. You know, they're like ants. You just step on one, and there's 20 more that's born after that. So just take one. That's how they think. So I think that clip was quite profound, and it just really, really elucidates white psychopathology on a very basic level. I remember when we read Ben Tillman's and the reconstruction of white supremacy on the cows, and he has made a statement in the book, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, if you barely scratch the surface on a white American, you will find the same savage that roamed the hills of England many years ago. So he basically said what I've always said: the white people that's your doctor, the white people that is at your meat market, the white person you ride next to on the bus, the white person that you sit next to wherever you're going, they're no different than the people from the 1600s. The difference is they wear better clothes. That's it. That is it. And he basically said that if you scratch the surface on us, you're going to find the savage beasts that roam the hills of Europe, terrorizing the countryside pretty much. And this is Ben Tillman long ago. So very powerful thing. And what it made me think of, I don't know if you saw the clip I posted on BTR Community in regards to the black woman who had moved to Colorado. She was trying to move to a better environment for her children, have them in a better school, better quality situation so that they can excel and be the best young black children they could be. She had no idea that she moved right next door to an arch white supremacist. And this is what I say all the time. You have white neighbors, you don't know who the heck they are and what the heck they're into. And they could be nice, very pleasant, cordial, and have black people tied up that they're chopping to pieces in their basement, and you would have no idea. Just like Jeffrey Dahmer lived in a black neighborhood amongst black people, and no one had any idea until they started dragging out body parts and it stunk to high heaven from all the black males and non-white males that he dismembered. So in any way, this woman moves to Colorado, had no idea she moved next to an arch white supremacist. And she said that shortly after she moved in, he started calling her all kinds of niggers and black bees and all this stuff. He's just on a regular basis. And he stabbed her dog multiple times. It was like a pit bull. And the dog was, I mean, when she showed a picture of it in the video, and the dog was stabbed up like it was a deranged horror film sort of attack. The dog almost died, but it survived. And then she broke down on the camera because of the damage done to her animal. And then she said that he actually pulled a shotgun on her, called her all kinds of niggas. She recorded it so you could hear him calling her all kinds of nigger bitches and all this crazy stuff. And then she said she's terrified because she said her children go to school in one direction. She goes to work in the other direction. And she has to keep an eye on them because she has this next door neighbor who on a regular basis calls her racial slurs, has already threatened her with a gun. The police have done absolutely nothing about it and stabbed her dog up multiple times and almost killed the dog. So, I mean, this is what you have to be careful of. I know that a lot of times we move into areas, some of us, we live amongst our own people, and sometimes our own people are sometimes just as deadly or dangerous, but there's nothing like a white supremacist. And she was at the business end or the wrong end of a shotgun while this man was calling her all kind of N-words out the wazoo. So just please, please, please understand that you should have a healthy suspicion of any white person you come in contact with, no matter how pleasant or nice they are, because that is always a possibility of the kind of person that you're coming in contact with. So, yeah, that's one, but let me run through some of the other ones before it gets too crazy. The next one, Russia developing a long-range missile that pretty much cannot be stopped by their adversary. They took a page out of the U.S.'s book because they said the missile was pretty much similar to the Tomahawk missile, which was developed in the United States. So, again, the United States doesn't want Russia to have the same capabilities that they have, but now Russia does, and they probably have for a long time. This really speaks to what Brother Dave been saying on Tando for a very long time, and especially in recent months, he's been talking about this missile situation with Russia and the fact that they've advanced in ways that America is really not prepared for, and this is just proof positive. Remember last year, Jenna, when we did the discussion, it's either last year or 2016, when we had the article that dealt with Russia building Terminator-type robots
yes.
that can actually shoot on the field. So imagine America going to war, sending whatever troops into battle, and they're fighting Terminator.
Yeah, at that same time, we was also discussing about the submarines kept surfacing around Alaska also. And in that same clip that
Absolutely.
You're talking about, you know, they trying to make these stationary where they can just mount them on land. So, you know, it's
right.
It's getting real serious with a lot of the people paying attention to the show that's going on. It moves
300 to 3,400 miles. It can fly too. They said that's a long range.
And they have a couple missiles that have unlimited range. So
exactly. And then also recently, I know you saw the article. I put it on BTL as well. About DARPA developing bullets that can track people. So you can try and run from it, but the bullet will follow you. Just like you would see in, was it Mission Impossible or one of the movies with Angelina Jolie, where they
Domino.
Had bullets that could actually follow
Domino.
You?
When they was bending the bullet.
Yeah, they actually
well,
have
it might
them
not
now.
Have been. It was
so
Wanted.
I could
it was called it Wanted.
Say it again?
It was called Wanted.
Yeah, Wanted, that's it. Yeah. So, I mean, you can try and move out the way of the bullet, and it will follow you. So there it is. We're going to, like, a whole nother level as far as the ability to kill human beings. So this is, like you said, it's something to really pay attention to because it's getting serious. The African origin of game. I've talked about that for a very long time. And the oldest known game, Senet. Which is the precursor to chess. That's it. I mean,
one of my favorite
things
games.
Were developed with the. Go ahead.
Said it's one of my favorite games. Chess.
Oh yeah, mine too. Yeah, mine too. I actually had the time to play as much as I would like to because I actually forgot all my different skills and talents that I haven't had anyone to play with for years. So I got to find a partner. But ultimately, games were meant to train the mind on how to think and make decisions using abstract concepts and ideas. And it was an intelligence building tool. As the brother so eloquently discussed, all the way up to video games, the origin of the video game cartridge was an African. So in every aspect, we have been integral in the development of games, and games always had a purpose. When you read about, or if you ever saw the documentary Bowling for Columbine, the two white males that went on the shooting rampage, they learned how to become almost expert marksmen by playing video games, first-person shooter games. The military uses first-person shooter games as well to do the same thing, and in order to draw in young people to join whatever faction of the military, Marines, whatever, they use them for that purpose. Also, if you study the medical industry, doctors play video games between surgeries so that they can learn and in eye coordination when they're doing surgeries using robots where the doctor's manipulating the robot in the human body to save a person's life. The idea of being able to use a joystick the same way you would use it in a video game to accurately, you know, do surgical maneuvers in the human body. That's all documented.
Yeah.
So there is the power of games. That, and that's just a few things, but there's so much more to it. Go ahead.
That goes into the a few different things too. And they've showed us this on the big screen, but before I talk about that book, we gotta start the book club back up, because that Fantastic Voyage, they talked about that, having the technology to be able to program these particular antibodies, initially using a joystick to go through the arteries, unclog arteries and what have you, and eventually them being able to seek out the dead cells, viruses and what have you.
Yeah.
So we got to finish that. But they showed this on the big screen with a movie called, here recently they had one called Ready Player One. And that was more of the
To watch that.
Yeah, that was more of the virtual reality. But it was another one where they had this child, like, let's just go with 10 years old. I can't be sure if that's right or not, but let's just say 10 years old. And he was playing video games, and in actuality, he was destroying different planets so that the humans can inhabit those parts. So, and that goes to right now, what they've been talking about on Tando with the and Brother Scotty. Shout out to Scotty with the space race, you know. So all of these things have been shown to us, that, but it doesn't, the sting per se has been taken out because we done seen it. And now when they showing it to us on the news with the intentions on going ahead with the actual mission, we kind of just look at it side-eyed and keep on going.
It's called psychosocial conditioning. They get you comfortable with it so that it doesn't have any sort of shock effect on the mind. It's easier for you to accept it as normal and keep it moving. You know, it's no different than what, if you ever saw the movie They Live, and I always discuss how white people function. Like, they're the most deadly creature ever existed on the planet is a white human.
So you got your counter racist glasses on.
Go ahead.
I say you got your counter racist glasses on. That's how you see them.
Yeah, and the crazy part is they've conditioned their victims to see them as benevolent. So when you have black people that go into black neighborhoods, we'll be questioned about why we're there, what gang we with, whatever the case may be, but a white person can come to the same neighborhood and no one says a word to them.
Not a word.
That's how conditioned we are. And that's kind of what it is. Like, I don't know if you saw a movie that came out last year. I recently saw it. It's called Extinction on Netflix. And it's an incredible movie because it's the first movie I saw where it tells the opposite side, or the far tail end of what the Terminator tried to do. Like in Terminator, they were trying to prevent the destruction of the planet and human beings by artificial intelligence. This one basically is a movie where human beings have been removed and they live on Mars because AI has created these human robots, and basically they've taken over the entire planet. So there's no humans on the planet Earth, but these people, they look like people. And human beings come back to the planet and start killing off these seeming human beings that we find out are actually robots. And their memories have been wiped clean. So they have no memory of the fact that they are the ones who drove humans off the planet in the first place. And the humans that come in, they're presented to us as invaders. So you're watching it, rooting for these robots to win. And in the end, you find out that it's actually the displaced humans coming back to take their planet from AI that's inhabited it for hundreds of years.
Man,
it's an incredible movie.
We'll have to go back and see who wrote that. That could be interpreted in so many different ways.
Hey, but it's conditioning again.
Before we get too far off, let me get to that Liam Neeson clip. For me, it reminded me of when he a while back, I can't remember exactly when it was, but it was right when the Me Too thing started happening, and they was talking about, he done an interview about the pay gap. I think it initially started with like Mark Wahlberg, and some and a woman that he was working with, and they asked Liam Neeson about it, and he was like, "Yeah, they should get what they need to get and equal pay and all of that." And they was like, "Would you give up some money?" He was like, "Oh no, no, we ain't doing none of that. You know, they need to figure that out themselves."
That sounds about right.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what I felt. I felt that same kind of narcissism in this interview, where he was where he was like, "I ain't racist, but you know, I have wanted to kill a few of them." That's what I heard. You know, "I ain't racist, but I have wanted to kill a few of them, but I had to talk myself out of it." And then he tried to blame it on.
Like Tom Williams said, "I shake your hand."
Yeah, that's why I played some of those clips to go exactly with that, because we have this going on all of the time. Just here recently, I couldn't find the article, so I ain't put it in. But that right there, that interview speaks to exactly how a lot of these suspected racists feel. They just charged the guy who stabbed the black man in the back with the sword.
Yes.
And even labeled him a terrorist, a white supremacist.
Yes, they did. Yeah, you're absolutely correct.
So that's what that clip made me think of, was that specifically. And how many of them have been getting away with it, especially these slave catchers out here. You know, I was almost a victim of one of those slave catchers. So.
Absolutely.
But the next clip that intrigued you, because I thought that Soulja Boy clip, it was a lot of people.
I had that written down too.
Say again.
I had it written down too, but go ahead, go into it.
No, I was saying that Soulja Boy clip, it was a lot of people just bashing him, bashing him, bashing him. Whether it's for language, brashness, as Nelly Fuller would call it, show offism, and totally belittling his entrepreneurial spirit. Now, how many times have we heard that? And it don't mean you don't have to have a lot of money for it. You could just be trying to do something small. And just get clowned. And then we followed that with the that was a nice find that you had as far as the games, because that goes right into the technology of the Russian article about how this high technology and a lot of it is being played, excuse me, not played, but are being driven by joysticks.
Absolutely. Even with the drones. Remember, they fly drones, and the people are sitting in silos underground in the U.S., and they're flying drones in Afghanistan, bombing weddings and hospitals. And it's, for them, it's like a video game. I think they had a nice episode on Cyber Wars about that, and it looks just like a video game. So the person is not computing that in the moment that when they press that button, they're killing human beings. They make you, they put it in the, where they dehumanize the victim and leave you in such a detached state that you're detached from all the killing that you do. Whereas when you would see bombers during the Vietnam War or World War I or World War II, the pilot is over the city. They're watching the bomb do complete havoc. So they have no confusion about the fact that they're destroying life. You understand? Like when you hear those pilots describe their experience, they are in tangible touch with the lives that they have taken, because they're watching the entire landscape disappear into rubble. In this situation, you're sitting in a building and everything's on a screen, so you're completely removed. So it's like you can probably kill as many people as humanly possible and not really care, because in your mind you're not putting everything together in a cohesive manner due to the method that you've been indoctrinated into practicing violent warfare on non-white people around the world using drones. And that's the example we're using. So it's real. Your ability to put those things together is just really, really powerful, because it gets no realer than that. And to think that something that was developed by African people to try and raise the bar in regards to intelligence and the ability to think critically has now turned into tools of expert marksmanship for killing of other human beings and video game style mass murder in the form of drone strikes. But there you look at how these things work in the hands of African people without who never had negative intentions, and then how it ends up being used in the hands of white supremacists. Whenever they get a hold on anything, the first thing they do is they weaponize it. So that's their culture, to weaponize everything. Just like African people had gunpowder long before anyone else. The difference was they never used it to kill people. They used it ceremonially in paying homage to specific deities. And that was pretty much its purpose outside of any sort of practical uses in the field as far as starting fires and things of that nature. But they never used it, and they never weaponized it, is what it is. And then what? It ends up in the other people who are not African and becomes weaponized in the form of the fire stick, then developed and perfected in the Near East into becoming what would become known as the gun. So, I mean, like, it gets so deep when you start to study and you learn that things that were created for a benevolent, beneficent purpose by African people gets commandeered and weaponized by other groups, specifically most white folks, but then you also have the Chinese who have done that sort of stuff and others. But the idea is that weaponizing, you know, and it really just ties into the fact that when we read Chancellor Williams' book, and he talked about the fact that we didn't really get into this culture of death and mass murder like this until we encountered other folks. And we went into the nonviolent conflict, and we went into the ancient history of Pan-Africanism via lineage ties and things of that nature. Matter of fact, it was something else I was going to bring up. When you played the... Oh, you are now live on Real Life, the radio show with myself, Rod, and my co-host, Dennis F. Ross. Thank you for being with us this evening. If you do wish to call in and make a comment or ask a question, give us a call at 704-802-5056. Again, that's 704-802-5056. Press star if you wish to ask a question or make a comment, and please watch your background noise. Thank you once again.
Sorry about that.
No problem. It's all good. We had to definitely, you know, pause for the call, as they say. yeah, so I was saying that kind of ties into the clip on Quilombo dos Palmares. And when the sister was discussing this history, and I wanted to implore everyone, there's a great movie. I've had it for years on VHS, but I think it's now on DVD, and you might be able to find it
on YouTube, probably.
Maybe if you... on YouTube or even if you have like a fire stick or something, but it's called Quilombo. And actually in that video, there's clips from the film, which I actually own. and it is powerful to see self-governing African people transported to Brazil during the slave trade. It's just a powerful movie based on that true story. And the best part about it is what she said when she said this was a self-governing society. And when we read Chancellor Williams' work, the same one I was referring to, the section where we dealt with the Pan-Africanism and lineage ties and all of that, what did Chancellor Williams say in that work? He said the highest expression of African societal development was not one that was ruled by a king or queen, but self-governing societies where no one person was in charge. Everyone knew their role in the society and they worked collectively, no different than a beehive or an anthill. So what you are seeing is the origin of self-governing. That is what they're doing in Catalina, Spain. That is why the Spanish government is trying so hard to subdue those people and put them back under the rulership of the governing body. That is an African concept, to not need a king or queen or any sort of leader or any fiefdom or feudal ruler or anything, but human beings coming together collectively. And this is where the concept of community comes from, because community is a combination of the word common, unity. You have to come together around a common theme. And if that theme is survival, then there's not going to be rape. There's not going to be crime. There's going to be equitable distribution of goods and services, so no one's left out in the cold starving to even have the need to commit a crime. So these are the sorts of societies that we came from. Some of our people developed these things to high degree. And we can't even agree on the fact that we're in a system of white supremacy. And then you can layer it with all the other ideological tribalism that we each latch onto with each other. So, man, again, we're getting multiple examples here of the ability of African people to get along, to see through the BS and really make something new out of a new situation that started from something terrible. And here we argue about the pettiest thing and we get nowhere as a people. It's shameful. It's really shameful when you think about it, because we should be doing way better than that. It really. And just to add this, I was watching a video with the Hebrew Israelite, the guy who started the whole beef with the Native American elder and the racist white supremacist crowd that surrounded him. Yeah. And he was talking and he had said in the video that, you know, man, the seed is with the man, da 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 da. He's running on. And I just wanted to say this, that I posted on BTR Community. A seed is the female sex organs of a plant or a tree, which is really a tree, because seeds come from trees. Flowers come from plants. So the seed is the female sexual organs of a tree. Pollen is the sperm, which comes from the male aspect of a tree. And it's the pollen that impregnates the seed so that the seed can create a new tree. So words are important. And the seed of a human female is the egg. The pollen of the human male is the sperm. So we dictate the sex of the child via which one of the sperm connects with the egg first. But it is the woman who is the creator. She is the carrier and bearer of the human species. So that's the black woman right there. So please stop saying that. It's incorrect. And you're basically doing some transgender, effeminizing nonsense using the term seed incorrectly. Seeds are female sexual organs of a tree. Let's end it there. Words are important. So I just wanted to actually touch on that because it was just so agitating, because he was so adamant in his correctness. And I'm like, dude, you couldn't be more wrong. And I could just see a thousand or if millions of people potentially coming in contact with that video and propagating that, because I've heard that almost all my life. And I'm like, you guys can't be more incorrect. And no one's ever stopped you to tell you this. But I just had to say that. It's nothing to do with him being Hebrew Israelite. He just happened to be the one propagating that false message on a wide platform. He was also interviewed by the New York Times and all kinds of stuff. So his reach is major to be giving out misinformation like that. But go ahead. What are you going to say, Jenna?
I'm still trying to figure out where that had just came from. But I agree, your words are important. What I was actually going to reference that guy also, and I was going to reference him to the fact about the clip about the police. Initially, when it first came on, it was a police union chief, and he stated that they would not be taking any anti-police rhetoric anymore. And when the I think his name was Big Hebrew, Ultimate Hebrew. Sorry for getting his name wrong.
His name
wrong.
Was Israel something or something Israel. Because I remember them asking him in the clip that I watched with him talking. Because it was a long video. It was like maybe an hour and change. And I sat through close to an hour of it. I didn't get to finish it because I was at work. And I just remember when I saw him say that, he was just so convinced. You know, and he's just looking this white guy in the eye, and he's just adamant on how right he is.
Well, that part ain't even the part I'm talking about. I didn't get that. I didn't even think about that. But I'm going to now. But the part I was about the police talking about, they're not going to be taking any more anti-police rhetoric and what have you. They going to be watching. What'd he say? We will be watching you from now on. When I seen like that about the the Hebrew Israelite being brought to the national, because I've been known about the group, but I've never heard them discussed on a national platform. When this first happened, I asked you and some of the other callers, do you think this will have any kind of following? And I don't think I used those words, but what I was meaning is, do you think this will cause more harm than it supposedly had helped? And you have the BIE, I have referenced that also, and now you have different sects of people, certain groups or what have you, that are going to be feeling the blunt of that clip that we played. They are going to be targeting those groups. And it was a lot of white people who was in that clip. And I know most of you know it was white people because they continued to talk crazy. Had it been one of us, not so much. So once again, with that clip that I played, do you think that's going to help or harm us? Because I've seen a lot of YouTubers talking about them, but instead of thinking about how the police, these slave catchers, are going to be keeping an eye out for Hebrew Israelites. At first, it was only the Moors. Now, to me, just my thought process, I'm thinking, once you see that showing up on a big scale like that, you can almost be sure that all of the rest of the six of black people who have their own groups are going to be getting, you know, like pinpoint, excuse me, that wrong terminology, but they're going to be focused on in a different type of way now, especially with the birth rates going down, crime going down. So they still need to fill these prisons up. Because as we remember, Donald Trump reversed the act that Barack Obama put in, which, like Scotty has said repeatedly, he waited too late so this could happen. So these are just some of the things that I see with these different actions popping around not only just this country, but the globe.
Excuse me. Let me mute myself real quick.
No worries.
Okay, yeah, that just came out of nowhere. My bad. What I was going to say was, to me, it's like a twofold thing. Now, it's twofold in this sense. Like I said, Hebrew Israelites are not focused on white supremacy. They're focused on the religious thing.
So white people in general don't have anything to fear from them. And most of their angst, agitation, and rage tends to go towards other black people because they don't think they're African. And they have this whole biblical narrative with all the different 12 tribes making up different groups. So really, they're more of a problem for other black people than they are for white people, unless the white people are those that they consider Gentiles.
Well,
and they consider not of.
I agree with you.
Go ahead, because
I agree with you on that point. My fault, Ross. I agree with you on that point, but I'm not even talking about from an ideology standpoint. Just the fact
no,
that
I'm
you
going
see,
further. Go ahead. So finish your thought.
My apologies. I was just gonna say that a big black man aggressively approaching white people, especially this day and time, it puts you on notice.
I'm gonna address that too. That was in the other side of it, but I'm gonna get into that right now. Not now, but let me finish this first. So as far as the ideology is concerned, he actually told the interviewer that there are white people that can become Hebrew Israelites. Hmm. And he kind of went into, he actually said that, and he went into his interpretation as to why that's possible. I forget the details because, like I said, I saw it for about an hour. He did explain it, but I don't remember off the top of my head
I think you're talking about where they say they're like they more of cousins rather than being related
and basically,
with
like
Africans.
They can learn the tradition, like they can kind of be indoctrinated and bought in if they're of a certain mindset is basically what he was alluding to. And so as far as that's concerned, it kind of takes the quote-unquote racism out of it because, they always say, oh, Hebrew Israelites are racist, da-da-da-da-da. But if you also have provisions to allow some whites into your group, then pretty much you can't say that they're racist. But what it does do, because of their aggressive stance that they took and the fact that they stood up to these white folks and agitated these white folks, it's going to bring scrutiny on anything that they consider a fringe group. And the Hebrew Israelites are considered a fringe group.
Right.
So anybody else that's doing anything that's been low-key, possibly off the radar and on the come-up, you're going to be under federal radar just because of what they pulled there. Because what you said is absolutely correct about these black people stepping to white folks like they did and now ending up on the national stage and actually global stage now because he's getting attention everywhere.
Right.
Now, the other aspect of this where it can get ugly for them is that they've been watching them for the longest. Rabbi Wentworth Matthews started the original Ethiopian Orthodox Jewish Church in Queens. He was good friends with Dr. Ben, and he used to have Dr. Ben speak to his congregation and parishioners regularly. Now, so they've been watched ever since, like, way back then. And you're talking, like, the 50s or 60s that Rabbi Wentworth Matthews came here from the Caribbean, if I remember correctly, and moved forward. And off of them is where the Hebrew Israelites actually spun off. Now, the thing with that is, now that they've come up with this aggressive stance, they're going to be under more scrutiny. But they also let law enforcement know that it would be easy to agitate them. And we know that you got killer cops that wake up sometimes and say, hey, I'm going to kill me a black man today. And they'll do something to agitate you. Since Hebrew Israelites are known to get aggressive and physical with people who they're yelling at in public, all the cops have to do is send one of their people up to agitate them. And if they attempt to physically assault the person, the cops will just shoot them. Mm. So they're letting everyone know we're willing to get aggressive. You know, done it before. They're known to do that. Like I said, I grew up seeing them downtown Brooklyn all the time, going off on folks. I've seen them attempt to get physical with people and in some cases get physical with people. So basically, once you let people know that you are able to be agitated, then they can set you up for the ultimate checkmate in the form of killing you. So that is the other side of that I was trying to get at. Is that it's not good for a couple of reasons. And that those are the main ones that stood out to me in regards to exactly what you were talking about.
Agreed. And I know we're finna get ready to come up on this break, but before we get to this break, the one about the old white people, in the telling people not to vote because they gonna be there. Man, I thought that was so hilarious. And the reason I thought it was hilarious because it's true. We have talked about the meaninglessness of the presidency. Because, you know, as we continue to go through that and digging and reading, we find out, you know, because I'm sure a lot of people didn't know that the Electoral College elects the president. It's as easily as I can say that right now, I'm sure it was a lot more people know about it now than they did previous till it being brought up, whether it was on the news or some side persons, whoever told them. It was new. But the local elections are where these old people, I see them all the time when I be voting, when we talking about like the sheriff, the school council, just anything. They make time, especially with how most of us, not all of us, but most of us are always at work. They make time.
Even white people have the most free time.
Yeah,
they have
even
more
the
free
ones
time than
who,
anyone else.
Even the ones who still have to work, they make time to go down there.
Well, they get the time
vote.
Off. Yeah, I can take the time off when I want. Yeah, you absolutely right.
So I just wanted to play that for the seriousness. I hope you got you a giggle out of it and then thought about how serious it is. Because they're telling us, they're shooting up candidates and what have you right now. And I couldn't find the one about the guy who showed up in blackface. I couldn't get that at the last minute. I don't know what happened to it. But that's the exact result of us not thinking it matters. What were you about to say, Ross?
Oh, I was just going to say, it just shows how successfully we've been conditioned against our own best interest. Because there's a lot of black people who have problems with voting, which you're VGQ, you're entitled to feel how you feel. It's not a problem, but...
And I will understand
thing,
why.
You know, you say it again?
I say I understand why you have those doubts about voting.
Oh, yeah, I get it. The thing is that, to me, they're taking a holistic approach to something that has many layers, though. And that's where the mistake is made, because remember, and I always say this to people, anything that white people try to stop black people from doing is exactly what black people should be doing. So them stopping you from voting was to keep you out of local elections. That was the whole purpose of it. Because, like you said,
The question should be why they're trying to keep us from voting if voting don't mean anything.
Well, the main reason is because the people you vote for in your local elections affect your daily reality on the ground. It affects your experience with law enforcement, because if you elect a sheriff who's no nonsense about white supremacy, you're going to see a different set of behavior from the officers you encounter. If you put a person in city council or in other positions that can be equitable in regards to how housing practices are dealt with, then it can change your ability to get into a better situation without having to necessarily move to a white neighborhood to do so. So there's so many different things you can change for yourself. If you want to facilitate changing marijuana laws in your local county, where it's like, I don't want people being arrested for this nonsense. You know, it's a victimless crime. If you vote people into the key positions in the law that are of that same mindset, then you can change that on the ground. So that's where, to me, the potential mistake can be made, is in taking a holistic approach to saying, I'm just not voting, and you say, I'm not voting at all. And then you wonder why your daily reality is so screwed up, and why you have these people that you look at every 4 years that you're like, oh my gosh, this person has voted in again, but you're not doing anything to change it. So it's really about trying to get as educated as possible about the process so you can make a conscientious decision to decline certain aspects of the political process that are non-effective, like voting for the president.
Well,
but when it comes to doing things that can change your daily reality, you want to definitely be as involved as humanly possible because it can affect your everyday life. Go ahead. What are you going to say?
Well, you know, it is February, so a lot of people who don't never talk about Black history or some don't even think about it. It'll be being brought up this month at least. So, you know, one of the things that I hope a lot of people run across, because I know Malcolm X is going to be one of the prime topics, and I hope they remember to run across the speech where he talked about we should be involved in everything, no matter what it is. And yes, that mm-hmm. does include slave catchers. But I'm not sure how that hasn't worked out thus far. But we still should be involved. That's all I had for that. So you want to run us into the break real quick, and then we'll get to the end and discuss this Dr. Curry speech.
Sure. No problem. You're live on Real Life, the radio show brought to you by Foundational Radio Network via Black Talk Radio Network. If you do wish to call in, make a comment or ask a question, give us a call at 704-802-5056. Again, that's 704-802-5056. Press ** if you wish to ask a question or make a comment, and please watch your background noise. Thank you.
Yeah, so where would you like to start with Dr. Curry? Because we see that happening right now. You know, it's actually a great transition because it's going on right now in the election process.
You are correct. And the thing about what Dr. Curry said, and I just love the way that he thinks, because his research is so impeccable. When he takes a particular position, he backs it up impeccably with, you know, just viable sources that are amazing. And that's what I love about him as a professor and just an educator. For me, being a historian and researcher, it is just refreshing to come across his kind of scholarship. But what really hit me was when he was going into the history of Black feminism, and he talked about the fact that because Black women are the most educated group, non-white group in the country, that you have these Black women now that are competing with Black males for corporate jobs. So now you have enmity being created by the race, and the race now is between Black men and women. We're no longer working together. We're trying to beat each other out of the best possible position on the white man's plantation. So you have that competition that he brought up. Then what you see is that the history of white women, that's why I implore people to read a book called The Iceman Inheritance by Michael Bradley. He is a writer and a researcher. Actually, him and Dr. Clark, matter of fact, Dr. Clark wrote the foreword in his text. But he goes through the origin and history of sexism and racism and violence in white society. And he discusses the fact that when white people lived in caves, that men, this is the origin of patriarchy, was that men are more valuable than females in European society because men had to go out and hunt every day for fresh meat, for animal skins, for clothing to stay warm, things like that. So the most important people in their society were people who were successful hunters, and that tended to be men. Now, as a result, women were considered to be more of a burden because, especially when they were pregnant, they were eating for more than one, so they're eating twice the amount of food, but incapable of being able to contribute anything because they were physically incapacitated via pregnancy. So females became less important, and they had a habit of killing every third female. Sometimes they would even eat them Also, and he discusses this in the book, how the women were passed around. So a person, a white person growing up amongst their group, the mother would sleep with her son, would sleep with the father, would sleep with the father's brothers. Like they, that's where the origin of like basically passing the woman around came from, was from their ancient history, because there were less women in the society since men were considered more important. And also you had men going on long excursions out to hunt. So there was a sexual connection as well. The men who were the best hunters also had the pick of other men for sexual conquest. And then leaving the women behind for long periods facilitated lesbianism amongst the women. And because they also kept their animals in their caves with them, sometimes they would sleep with the animals too. So this is, and this is all him discussing this in the book and the historicity of this lifestyle. And this is the origin of what we see today, which became feminism. White women were wholesale subjugated by their men the entire time they've been with them. So as a result, this movement was created around giving them more rights, and because basically white men own their women. That's the way their society was from ancient times. That's the way it ran up until very, very recently in modern history. So this is the origin of the white feminist movement, was them fighting not to be owned and controlled by their men. Even when you go to the South, it was the man who was considered the head of household. He basically owned his wife and his children. And it's discussed also in the book, Birth of a White Nation. She goes into this, how the man controlled and dominated everything. Jacqueline Battaglia talked about it in that text. And what he also described was the fact that, because when you study the history of black women, you find that they were the most basically liberated women on the planet. Because when you, whether it was West Africa, South Africa, or even when you look at the Zulu Nation is one of the few patriarchal African societies. There were patriarchal societies in Africa. The Zulu Nation was one of them. But when you study, you'll find that even though it was a patriarchal society because it was ruled by a king, and because of the way that the society was structured, women held a high place. Shaka Zulu's wife was known as mother was known as the great elephant, and she was just as revered as he was by the people. So even in a patriarchal society, women had the role and got their respect. So what you were looking at in Africa was, when you study the Nile Valley, you study some societies in West Africa, the Songhai and others, black women owned property. They could divorce their husband if they were mistreated. They could pass down property to their descendants. This is all stuff white women never were able to do. They had to do it through their men. And if the man had a different idea as to which of their children would get whatever they had to leave behind, they could totally violate whatever the mother said and do what they wanted, because they were the head of the household. See, in Africa, it wasn't like that. Black women could actually pass on their assets to their descendants. They could divorce their husband if they were mistreated. They could get remarried. You even had certain societies where the women ran things. So it was a total antithesis to what white women experienced. So for black people to be indoctrinated into feminism, basically white women projected and superimposed their historical relationship with their men onto black women and created a reality that did not exist, using black men and putting them in the same position that white men were in their lives from time immemorial. And black women bought that. Because remember that we discussed the fact that black feminism was a CIA psyop in which they gave Gloria Steinem $2 million when she was in college. The CIA gave her $2 million in order to facilitate birthing black feminism. And she found that woman, Michelle, I forget her name. There's actually a famous recent picture of her and Gloria Steinem together raising their fists in the air. And this woman was the first one to ever write about it. And that's when you started to see more and more, and this was all during the whole free love time, so everyone was still doing drugs and free sex and all of that. So you started to see lesbianism really take off in the black community following this the birth of this black feminist movement. You started to see more enmity between black males and females, and as black females went through the college experience, they were further indoctrinated against their own men. And we're seeing the culmination of that in the hashtag MeToo and all the other stuff that's taking place that is so anti-male, it is just nauseating at any point now. And that's why I've always said I prefer, like he says, race-conscious womanism, because it takes into account that both black men and women are victims and victimized. Does it mean that there aren't black men that mistreat their women and use their physicality and the fact that they're stronger than black women to mistreat and abuse and dominate some of them? Of course that happens. We're in a system of white supremacy. We are emasculated as a group. So any little way some of us can find, some of us, not all of us, can find to get what we think our manhood is, because I always say our manhood is a white version of manhood that's been given to us. So what we consider manhood is completely different than what I've seen amongst African men. Manhood in Africa is completely different than what we see here. A lot of what black people do is imitating white people and what white people have taught us masculinity looks like. So it takes into account the suffrage of both black men and black women, and it does not destroy the black family. So race conscious womanism, I would definitely go for that over black feminism. But I'm for equity. I'm for equal status in a relationship between men and women, because we both have roles to play. We both are important. No one is better than the other one. And that is the to me, the meat of what I'm seeing in what Dr. Curry talked about was the indoctrination of black women into going against their own best interest, being white, via white women superimposing and projecting their historical experience on black women and convincing them to take on that struggle as if it was their own all along. And that is the definition of power. The definition of power is the ability to dictate the reality of someone else and make them believe that they thought of it themselves. And that's what we're seeing with black feminism and the way that black women have been indoctrinated against their own best interest, that is culminated now in an entire system of destroying the black male character. And this, and most of these sisters are getting this indoctrination on college campuses. So is college holistically a bad thing? No. But always remember, you are sending your children to your enemy's school to be educated, and they will never educate you on the best means of thwarting their dominance over you. They're going to give you layers and different means of actually facilitating your domination without you being consciously aware of it. And that's what we're seeing. So you can add on to that. I hope I didn't talk too long.
Nah, you, that was great, and you made some great points. I agree with you. Like Dr. Curry stated, black women are the most educated people here in this country. What I have found being in school, and mostly I noticed this when I was just growing up, from the research that I done, that, like you said, there's always been equality, because it was an equal balance. I didn't know what to call it when I was viewing it from a child's viewpoint, but it was equal. And now, with all of the jobs, there used to be a standard to where men would provide and the woman would take care of the home. And I see you, Carla. We're going to get to you in just a second. I don't see nothing wrong with that being reversed, but the reality is most people do. So the dynamic changes. It's an ego. Egos have been crushed, especially men that have to take a back seat because they believe that they should be leading. So it's on everybody has been indoctrinated in a particular way to where there's going to be an issue no matter what. Both parties, the man and the woman, could be working, and just a few cents more would cause tension. We have been bred to the point of where we're competing with each other. And until I had really, really started studying white supremacy, I never understood why. It has become so much.
One thing I want to interject. before you continue, hold your thought for 1 second. The difference is black women, because they're the most educated, are being indoctrinated systematically and institutionally. Well, black males are being indoctrinated by society and media.
Well, I think it's both, on both ends, black males and women. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is that with us being beaten down, the only people that we can fight with is each other. And a lot of people look at that. They look at it from that standpoint. So, but before I continue on, caller, area code 478. What's your name? Where you calling from? What's your question or comment? Welcome to Real Life the Radio.
Hello.
Greetings. How are you, ma'am?
Greetings.
Hi. Good evening. My name is Kia. I've called before. Hope you're having the best evening you could have. It was very interesting. I've been listening since the beginning, just over the internet. There's a lot of information, and it's all good information. Before I get to the Dr. Curry part, to talk about the Liam Neeson part. Again, as I think you both listened to the other show, the context of white supremacy, you know, the context of that question was, how do you do all these movies about revenge? Because almost every movie he does is about revenge or avenging, or he's always fighting.
Yes.
He's never a happy person in movies. He's always fighting. And, like, that's the memory he went back to.
So you're saying that's the character that he's playing in those movies? Is that when he wanted to kill a lot of black people?
I can't think of, even in Schindler's List, he was, I guess, avenging the Jewish people, whatever, by taking them and putting them away. This man has never, as far as I know, and I haven't watched all his movies, I haven't watched most of his movies, but every time I see a commercial, he's fighting somebody. And he old, he about six, and he looked like he was fighting a long, long time.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. The majority of his movies are action movies where he's taking vengeance against someone who's done something to him or his family. You are correct. Not all of them. He does have like some romantic comedies under his belt and other stuff, but I would say the majority of his movies are those.
Yeah, but what he's famous for is for I'm a guy with a particular set of skills. That's what you're talking about.
Exactly. Yep.
And then I was just thinking the last movie, well, before this one, I guess it's coming out, which again is about avenging or something, is that Widows that he did with Viola Davis. And I remember her talking about she was being so excited and seeing as a sexual, it was beautiful by the white and blah, 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 when she got a fine black husband. So I don't get that at all. But whatever, low self-esteem, whatever, because she's very pretty, but whatever.
She's gorgeous.
Yeah.
I was wondering, did he take that part out of revenge what was done to his friend? Mm-hmm. That came to my mind.
Yeah,
maybe I've been listening to the cow too much or whatever. But I was like, well, why? Because he wasn't in the movie that long. I think in that movie he gets killed right away, and she has to avenge him and blah blah blah. I think I haven't seen it, but from what I understand, they're married. He's a criminal. He gets killed, and. But they do have some scene where they were together. They make sure they show that. And they were together. Now, I thought about that after, he said what he said. And I was like, wow. First to help and now to support her. She just stuck in these roles. And that
how to get away with murder. Yeah, she went from sleeping with a white man to sleeping with a white woman. I was like, oh, my God.
I only saw the one that Mr. Reed recommended when they were talking about the 13th Amendment crossover. That's the only one of that shows I've ever seen. That one when they talked about that. So that's what I thought about. I don't know if I told my mother. I said, I know that's kind of deep, but that kind of seems logical. And, no one should be surprised. Oh, my God. And I know we haven't talked about it on this show because it just happened on the weekend. The governor and his racism blackface, whatever, that guy in Virginia.
Yeah.
I just decided that we should have a list ready for our demands, because they are coming out the woodwork, and they want to say they're sorry, and we can go, well, because, you know, they always want our forgiveness and blah, blah, blah. Well, if you do this, and this, then we'll think about forgiving you. We need to capitalize on these moments and start saying,
oh,
the person needs to step down.
This is a
perfect opportunity for us to get for every black person in Virginia to get exactly what they want. This is the time. This is your best time
use
to get whatever
every,
you want.
Use every opportunity granted.
Go get it.
Yes, use every opportunity granted to you. Yes, I agree. You should capitalize. We should capitalize. But go ahead. I mean to interrupt
you. If you're listening from Virginia, go get it. Woo! I'm on your side. Woo! And then, now, finally, about the relationship stuff. And I agree that I'm a black woman. We're the most educated, I guess. But that doesn't mean the smartest. No, right. I mean, just because you're educated doesn't mean you're smart about men. I know I'm not. I'm single. I don't know. I have no clue. I know nothing. And in addition, you know, it's not just the education. Sometimes it's the environment of the education and other things.
Absolutely.
Because I was thinking about, you know, the movie Hidden Figures. They were all supposed to be highly educated, math genius women. Those three stars in the movie, all three of them had husbands.
Mm-hmm.
No, well, the one she got married to, the guy, and the other two had husbands who were loving and supportive, and there was no problem. Now, maybe it's because they didn't have no choice, so they went to the black school or whatever, but they were together. So it's more than just having an education.
It's how you're prepared by your parents, because I know my son went to a school where he got a scholarship for the whole 4 years he was at the school. It's always in the top three schools in the country. It's actually a high school that was used since the times of slavery. But actually, the children who went to that school used to be children of plantation owners, and they would send them up to Jersey to go to school to learn how to better keep their slaves. And most of those students would go from that school to Princeton. So this is the school that he went to, and I remember we went to a Yoruba priestess and got a reading done, and they know what me and my family is about in regards to Africa and just us propagating our history throughout his life. And they said to us, the main thing we have to do is keep him grounded in who he is, because it will be very easy for him to get lost in that environment. He had all kind of very, very affluent white people, a lot of them from out of the country, a lot of Chinese people and other people from the Far East, Middle Eastern people would come there, Caribbean people, and as well as American Africans as well. And he used to tell me some of his experiences, because it was a very, very white experience. And he would schooling people throughout his school career, because we gave him the foundation and reinforced it. Once he was on that campus and doing things, we made sure he was grounded in who he is. So now that he is in college, it's the same thing. But it's about that foundation you set from home in the first place, and their ability and your ability to work together with your child to make sure they maintain that, so that they don't lose themselves, because it's very easy to lose yourself in the process of assimilation. Anytime you go into a different environment, you're going to assimilate.
Hey,
and
that,
you can assimilate without... Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that just goes into being approachable to your family, to your children, your wife, or your husband. You just have to be approachable. Now, when we're talking about our children and laying that foundation, it doesn't mean being friends. It just being able to have an open conversation. But we running short. Mm-hmm. We got 15 more minutes. I wanna ask the caller, does she have did you wanna get into any more of the clips that you heard? Because I wanna finish my rundown
on
Dr. Curry.
Okay, go ahead.
No, but I agree with everything you said, but I wanted those who may be listening to this now or get to listen to the archives, is that we have to remember, I was stating before we took the caller that when I was growing up, all of the women in my family, they pretty much took care of the house. And when I say take care of the house, I mean they ran everything. And right now, when I was coming up, it was a lot of people who was a lot of men, not all, once again, not all, but a lot of men who sold drugs and was taking care of their children, families. And sometimes the woman would work, sometimes she would not. We fast forward, we have those same issues. Just back then, they were getting murdered by, we were getting murdered by each other, getting murdered by the police, and winding up in prison. Now we still have those same problems, but a lot of the people who pretend to sell dope that are not going to jail, they're just stay-at-home dads. And a lot of that frustration to where they can't get a job because maybe early in their life they had some type of incident, a felony charge maybe, a long stack of misdemeanors or what have you, and can't be afforded those opportunities to get those grants and loans for school. That's another reason why black women are so far ahead. So when you have those two different cultures, you have this woman moving up and this man that can't do anything, at least in his mind. Everyone doesn't think like that, but it happens more times than not. That caused that tension also. And I was just wondering, have either of you ever seen that particular situation be part of the problem and just didn't know how to address it at that time, whether you didn't know what to call it or just didn't understand what was happening?
Yeah, because I know that my generation, because we grew up, the overwhelming majority of us grew up in single-parent homes or with our grandparents, we grew up without our fathers. So the overwhelming majority of my friends, even those who did have a criminal background, they were all there for their children, all of them. Even if they were hardcore criminals, career criminals, they were there for their children. So what I think really is important, and this is why I think what Neely Fuller says, like, you should have like 200 questions that you have for your partner before you get into any sort of serious committed relationship. Part of it would have to be the discussion of the historiography of the black male experience and the fact that we have been emasculated in all areas of people activity. And in the overwhelming majority of cases, the black woman is going to make more money than her man. And that woman would have to be understanding that because she might make more money doesn't mean that she's the man in the relationship, that man has to live up to getting her respect and as the man of the household. And it's not dependent on how much money he's bringing in versus her. And once you're able to get past it, because that is a big psychological hurdle for us as men in general, and especially as black men. That is another thing that a lot of us don't know, is that to till the soil in the field in African culture is the woman's job. It was always said that it was the woman who developed agriculture. She's the one who had the relationship with Mother Earth in that way, where she was able to learn that how it worked. And one of the most demeaning things they did to black men when they brought them here from Africa was to demean them by putting them to work in the field like the women did. So from the cultural perspective, they were being womanized just by being forced to work in the field. Because in a lot of those societies, the men went out and did the hunting and providing, as far as bringing things from the forest and from the surrounding area that they could use to survive. And the woman basically dealt with all tilling of the soil and making of certain types of food goods and stuff like that, and maintaining the family. So there was a cultural emasculation that took place just by him being forced to work in the field, which was something traditionally that the African woman did. So it's all tied in together, but it's really about us having viable discussions about the things that are most important in maintaining a structural family unit that's functional under a system of white supremacy, with the understanding of the fact that there's certain things that are going to be a fact due to the fact that we are in a system of white supremacy trying to maintain a functional American African family. I hope I make sense.
Yes, you do. And thank you again. I always love when you come in and comment.
Yes, me too.
If you had something else, we would love to hear it.
Absolutely.
For me?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh. No, I don't have much. Like I said, I don't have a lot of experience. And what hasn't, I don't know if it, well, I could just tell me it did happen to me. No one taught me how to be in a relationship. Like, you see people, whatever, but I mean, one time my grandmother, I told her I wasn't going to cook eggs because I almost ate. Like eggs, she said, you're going to have to cook your husband eggs. I think that's all the advice I've ever gotten in my life. Not where to meet them, how to meet them, nothing. Zilch, zip, zippo.
Can I ask a question?
Interesting. Go ahead.
Nothing. I got go to school. That's what I got. Both sides, go to school, 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 go to school. And what? Go to school, go to school, go to school, go to school.
Can I ask
and
a question?
Get a job and what? Go ahead.
Now, I mean, I don't know if you have children or nieces or nephews. Do you?
No, I'm an only child. I don't have nephews. Nope.
Oh, okay. I'm just wondering because that's one of the things that I thought of. I have four daughters, and I can't tell them how to meet a man. But I can tell them what to look for based off of the crude thoughts I had coming up as a young child. Do you think that would have helped you any coming up as a young
black woman?
Well,
I think you
can
tell them where to meet them. I mean, don't go to the club. That might not be, I'm not saying bad people go to the club, but, you know, when you're intoxicated, Your judgment is impaired.
That's not
Think
the environment that you want to be in.
When you meet sometimes it is the physical environment. You know, if you go to school with a school that's mostly white, you might say, no, those are not the people for you. I mean, you have to make it as easy, as plain as possible. And then just the attributes, be nice, be the, whatever you think is important, you know, pass on. You should tell that. In fact, if it's possible, you and your wife or the mother or whoever, you should have a talk about it together. I don't know why people separate, oh, the boys talk to the boys, the girls talk. No, if you are a family, you want them to create a family, have a family conversation about families.
Now, it's interesting you said that because I do agree that that is a conversation that should be had. The other thing is that what you just made or you elucidated that stood out to me is the importance of rites of passage. Because in traditional African culture, women went through their rites of passage usually around the age of 13. They would be taken out into the bush and it would be them only with women. And they would learn about childbirth. They would learn about how to please a man. They would learn about how to hold down a household. All of the things that a woman would need in order to be a good wife to a husband or a good woman to a man, she was taught in that initiatic process. And boys went through the same thing. Sometimes between the age of 12 and 13, they would be taken out into the bush and they would be taught about how to please a woman. What a man's role is in the family, what a man's role is in society. They will usually go through the rites of passage to become an adult member of the society. So usually that would involve, depending on the tribe, scarifications and different physical feats, as well as sometimes spiritual feats, depending on which ethnic group you were with. So this was something where everyone understood their function based on the fact that they were isolated with the elders of their sex in their community, who would teach them what they needed to know. And like I said, women would learn how to please a man. The different things that you can try with your husband and things like that. They were taught that, just like the men were taught the same thing in their initiatic process. And then once they became adults and they were married to someone, usually the parents would marry them off. And then from there, they would get to know their spouse and build a relationship. And these were all things that were done with the community's best interests at heart. So it wasn't about, like in America, children have choice about who they're going to marry, and they talk about falling in love and all of that. But really, all of that is political. You have to be taught about that. That's not the way things really work. And in those societies, the parents actually chose who they felt was most compatible for their child. And weirdly enough, in a lot of those cases, sometimes they didn't even start off as love. They didn't even like each other in the beginning, but it turns into something beautiful. And there's a lot of stories like that. Not saying that they all work out, but in a great many of them, that's how it worked. It was the parents who did it, made the decision, and then the children ended up somehow making it work. And in a lot of cases, actually falling in love with each other, even in situations where in the beginning, they may not have gotten along at all. So these are all things that are important, because it's a holistic approach to raising children who are not gender confused, children who are not confused about their role in the family, who are not confused about their role in the community or in the general society. It creates stable human beings, is what I'm saying. When you look at Jewish culture, that's what happens. When you're a female, you go through a bat mitzvah, where they're initiated into adulthood, and the boys go through a bar mitzvah, where they're initiated into adulthood as men. They have rites of passage, things that they got from us when they were in Egypt and they were not slaves, that they took with them and they still practice to this day. So what you told me really brought to the forefront the need for the rites of passage and the need for both males and females to really go through, even if it's a family-based initiatic process, into the roles of their respective sex.
Ross?
Yes, sir.
Hey, that will make our 2 hours for tonight. Would you like to hit us off with the prayer?
Yes, sir. I'll do that. I would like to say thanks to Kia for calling in. We greatly appreciate your insight and your input. And your thoughts and ideas really generates a lot of ideas in our heads, too. We love to have that feminine perspective to also balance out the thoughts and ideas that we are, the things that we are discussing, I should say. Thanks to all the other callers and listeners. Thanks to you for spending this Tuesday evening into the night with us. I'm going to say the prayer now and we'll close out the show. Creator, we ask that you help us to remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us to remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time that we are in contact with another Black person. Like Gus always says, it has been time. Let's replace white supremacy with justice ASAP. And let's also end the prison industrial slavery complex and human trafficking. I am in the love of the all, and all love is in me. I am a part of the all, and the all is a part of me. I am one with the all, and the all is one with me. I can succeed as a part of the all and fail as an individual. I can be all that I wish in the all, as long as my wish is to stay in the all. I am never alone. The all is, I am. The all can, I can. The all does, I do. Once again, thank you for spending this Tuesday evening with us. Please stay safe. We'll see you again next week, Creator willing. Peace and love. Good night.